Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Leaders of hundreds of faith communities all over Wisconsin are kicking off an 11 by 15 campaign. They're calling for the state of Wisconsin to reduce the prison population to 11,000, which is about half its current level, by the end of 2015. The letter says, rather than build a system that simply punishes and diminishes people, we believe that the justice system must work to restore victims to wholeness, to restore our communities, and to help those who have offended to be restored to a productive role in our society. Two of the people in Milwaukee who are involved with the campaign are joining us in our Milwaukee studios. Reverend Willie Briscoe is with us. He has been an associate minister of the New Covenant Baptist Church since 2009. He had a 25-year distinguished career in law enforcement and corrections. He retired in 2009 as the deputy superintendent of the Milwaukee County House of Corrections. He has served for some time before becoming the president of MICA. He was a board member of MICA. MICA is the Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope, and he is with us in our studios. Reverend Briscoe, thank you very much for being with us once again.
Thank you for having me.
And also joining us is Mandela Barnes, who is currently the lead organizer for the Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope. He is a native of Milwaukee and attended Alabama A&M University, has been a tireless and vocal advocate for social justice. Thank you very much, Mandela, for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
This is an issue that's kind of been on the back burner for some time, and it's interesting that you've resurrected it. The fact that Wisconsin, if you could please tell us, has a very high incarceration rate when you look at what our neighboring states have. Why is it so high, and how high is it in Wisconsin?
I'll defer that to Mandela with the stats.
Well, the thing is that what we're putting people in these prisons for is it's an unjust issue, for one. I mean, we're putting people in jails that have underlying mental illnesses that need to be treated. These illnesses aren't treated. And then when the people are released, because, you know, a lot of times they assume, well, when people go to jail, they aren't coming back out. Well, the reality is they are coming back out, and they're coming back out with those same mental illnesses that they went into the prison system with, because those illnesses have not been treated. The real problem has not been met. So they're most likely to recidivate once they go into jail and they come out with the same illness. You know, a lot of drug addiction, drug problems, whatever the case may be, we just say, you know, let's just throw them in jail. That's the culture that we developed in this state. You know, our incarceration rate is abnormally high. You know, it fluctuates between 22 and 24,000 right now. When you look at a state like Minnesota, they don't even have 10,000 people in their prison system. And this 22,000 number doesn't even include the county jails. This is state prison.
So if you added the county jails, it would be much higher than that.
Yeah, I don't even.
What's Minnesota doing differently? That's a huge difference in prison population.
Right. For states that have, you know, pretty close to the same state population, we're about 5.7 million. They're about 5.3 million. The same demographic, same, like, the very comparable rates of crime, very comparable demographics.
Do we have more people in prisons here on drug charges, Reverend Briscoe, or what is it?
On drug charges, basically on all charges. The difference between states are their approach to incarceration and recovery. If you look at, just look at Milwaukee. Milwaukee does not have a dedicated Huber facility for individuals, a city this large. Waukesha is about to build their second one. We don't have the drug courts and the diversion programs that are needed to actually incorporate people back into the community when they go to jail. So we become a warehousing facility. Minnesota had looked at it and realized that the cost was astronomical, so they decided that it was more feasible to try to divert these people from prison and try to rehabilitate them than to store them in prisons. If you look at the average cost of incarcerating an individual for a year, you could actually send your child to college for that amount of money. For a four-year degree, there's up to $90,000 to incarcerate a juvenile. The average nationally for a an adult is about $50,000 a year. So if you actually take those amount of money off your tax burdens and place them in a constructive part of the community, it's a no-brainer to see that it's more feasible and it's more economical to use that money for some other reason.
Do we have a firm handle on what kinds of rehabilitation programs work so we can cut down? I don't know how high recidivism rates are, but we hear that they are high. Are there enough programs that are in place that are really good that allow people to change their lives significantly?
Well, that's the problem. There aren't enough programs. The program needs to be expanded. There's only about $1 million allocated towards treatment programs. It's the TAD program, which is the Treatment Alternatives and Diversions, and we're looking to expand that program. And, you know, nothing is going to be perfect. There's not going to be just a fix-all solution. However, people that go through treatment programs are much more likely to come back out with that illness being met and treated and not go back into the prison system and not commit other crimes once they complete the program.
What did you say? There was only $1 million for this program?
It's like $1 million. Yep.
That doesn't seem like very much money.
No, it's not very much at all.
Not at all.
Yeah. You have been in law enforcement in your other life for a number of years. What kinds of programs did you see in place that worked?
Well, just like my Mandela just mentioned, none of them are really funded enough to actually do any follow-up when individuals leave jails. If you send an individual to jail with a sixth grade education, in order for him to come back and be a productive member of society, he should at least attend a high school graduates level. That should be almost mandatory. We don't have the finances to make sure that happens. You have individuals that go to jail with untreated mental illnesses. While in jail, they can get that treatment or they can get diagnosed, but there's no follow-up once they go on the outside. There are no programs that will follow them and make sure that they are becoming productive citizens. So we are warehousing them, and then we putting them back out only to re-warehouse them again. And this is a big strain on the budgets of our communities. Now, when you see, like, now you're going to have elections getting ready to come up, the main thing you're going to hear is tough on crime. So it gives the public that perception that we can lock away our problems, that we can protect you by putting people in jail. That only works if they're going away for life. The majority of our people in jail are not in there for violent crimes. They're in there for alcohol or drug-related offenses or offenses of mental illness. So I saw that prevalent in my career. It was just appalling that the people with the talents that they had were behind bars that never were diverted into the things that they could use those talents in.
Well, why do we forget? Is it because it's politically expedient? It's a good campaign issue? Why do we forget that people, unless they've committed very serious crimes, as you say, return to the communities? They're our neighbors again.
Right. And like you said, I mean, you know, with election season coming up, a lot of people want to be tough on crime, but it's just pandering to create a false sense of security with people. And people like to feel safe. That's, you know, people's safety, that's going to rank number one on a list of pretty much anything. If you ask someone what's the most important concern to you, it's going to be safety. If people can feel safe but aren't truly safe because people are coming back out of prison that had maybe a minor crime that didn't really warrant an incarceration because of a mental illness, they're going to go in. They're going to come back out angry. Because this is what society has done, and they've placed them in prison because of a mental illness, something that needed to be dealt with that was not dealt with, a problem that wasn't met. So they're going to come back out another person, and our prison system doesn't really serve the purpose of rehabilitating as it's supposed to, because the programs there aren't available to rehabilitate people. And we talk about Minnesota because Minnesota is our next door neighbor, but let's really shift this, because we can compare a state like Alabama, which is pretty much our polar opposite. In the state of Alabama, they had budget strains. They had to take a hard look at the budget, and they said, what can we do? What can we change? And they really took a hard look at the budget, and the state of Alabama reformed their prison system and offered more treatment alternatives to, one, it lowered the prison population, two, it took a major strain off the budget, and there's a lot of budget talk these days because all of a sudden some money is missing, and money that should be in one place is now going to another place. And people really need to take a look at this from multiple angles, from an issue of justice, from an issue of budgetary means, from an issue of just really, you know, doing what is right and building communities and creating safer communities instead of putting people in jail by treating them.
So if you were going to sell this on the basis of budget concerns, you would say we could save how much money by going to alternatives to prison?
Let's see. I'll just say that the Wisconsin state corrections budget is over $1 billion, and Minnesota's is $425 million. So we're well over double.
That is a substantial amount of money.
This is a very substantial amount of money.
Substantial. Yes. We have a lot of people who would like to talk with both of you if you want to put your earphones on. Our number is 800-486-8655. One more question before we go to phone calls. I haven't asked you to explain what this program is, who's behind it. There will be leaders of faith communities next Monday, I believe, mm-hmm. who are announcing their support for this. It's a faith-driven request?
Yes, it is. It's actually being conducted by our state organization, which is Wisdom. We are the local affiliate, MICA, but there are 10 other organizations just like MICA in other cities around Wisconsin that are all taking up this issue in order to encompass the whole state. We want religious leaders to get on board because this is a moral issue. And speaking from the black community, we're creating a subculture of prison returnees in our community where these young men are coming back with no training, no hope, no prospects of jobs, and it's an increasing endeavor. Sooner or later, there's no consequence to being locked up. There's no reason to rehabilitate yourself. So we're winding up with a city that is basically within a city if we don't do something about it.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come up with a number? You want to reduce the population by 11,000 by 2015. Why those numbers in that year?
Well, the thing is, I wish I could give the exact year, but I want to say even a decade ago, this is not even an abnormal number for the state of Wisconsin. Not too many years ago, our prison population was below 11,000. I don't want to say a decade, but it may just be 10 years ago where our prison population level was at or around 11,000 inmates. So we just want to be able to go back to numbers that are somewhat just. I mean, with what I'm saying is the rate of crime had not changed significantly to double the prison population. There isn't two times the amount of crime in the state of Wisconsin.
Two phone calls. Our lines are filled. I'll give you our email address, which you can use as well. Here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And we start with Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. This is what the church should be doing. And congratulations to Micah for picking this up. I'm sure you're aware of this, that the prison industry has a very big presence in ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, or whatever it's called. And there's a lot of money to promote and lobby, as they have written legislation for states, to increase the sentences and to do everything that's advantageous to this industry so that they can strengthen their position in getting contracts to build prisons and to manage prison populations and so on and so forth. Do you see them as a potential threat to what you're doing? Could you comment on that, please?
Reverend Briscoe, is there a big lobby?
Oh, yes, of course. The prison industry is a large industry in this nation. It has become big business. Since 1982, we have actually increased our prison population in this country to 2.5 million people. There's no country on the planet that incarcerates more people than the United States. So it has become big business. There are businesses that have been created to facilitate products and whatever to these prisons. There are even college degrees now aimed at corrections. It used to be just a law degree. Now you can get a degree in corrections, prison management. It has become huge. Private citizens that can actually now own a prison. If you form a corporation, you can get a private prison industry. It's huge. What we're going against is an industry that is not going to go away. quietly and peaceably. So we're going to have to come up with alternatives in order to make sure that some of these cities in northern Wisconsin that are basically built around prisons, that these people are going to say, well, if I lose a prison, I lose my jobs. There has to be a means to replace that with some of the finances that are being saved. So we have a huge opposition.
Your thoughts on this lobby as well, Mendel?
Oh, it's definitely in line because there's money to be made from this. I mean, the prisons are the new gold, you know, with the big prison rush. That's what we're dealing with here, especially when prisons are privatized and the interests don't necessarily become those of the public. They become the interest of individuals and individual gain. Just going back to what he said, I mean, with on the person that can form a corporation to start a prison, I mean, you really have to take a hard look at, are we really doing what's right for a community? Are we really working to rehabilitate, or are we profiteering off from people?
Thank you, Mike, for the call. Ed in Wausau, hi.
Hi. One of my first jobs, I was recruited by a hospital in the Twin Cities. It was called Midway Hospital. It's part of Health East now, but it's right off of I-94 between St. Paul and Minneapolis. And I got a call from a nursing unit, and they said, a fellow wants to talk to you. He said some kids are casing your parking lot like they're going to take cars. And this fellow gets on the telephone, and he explains, you know, that he's watched these kids, and they're looking at cars. And he said, how do you get to your office? And I told him where to take the elevator down. And when I'm walking out to the parking lot with him, really tall guy, white guy, and he said, 10 years ago, he says, I was one of those kids. He said, what these guys do is they give master keys to the kids to break into the cars. Then the kids take the cars to these strippers, and they just use the body parts and stuff like that. He said, I didn't wise up till I was sitting in Stillwater. And he said, what Stillwater did is they gave me a program that showed me how leading, you know, making me into a car thief. And he said, but I wised up there. He said, it was the education that Stillwater gave him that led him to be on that parking lot with me to stop what was going on in that parking lot.
Mandela.
Well, clearly, that's an instance where you can see how treatment. Because he went in, there was a program, and not necessarily even treatment for mental illness, just programs, rehabilitative programs to rehabilitate a person. You know, instead of just putting someone into a box room with no sunlight, no interaction. That's like you said, Reverend Briscoe, like, just try locking yourself in your room for an entire day and see how you begin to feel. So, I mean, definitely there should be programs that are in place to really be able to transition a person for release.
There's so much in play when we look at this issue, isn't there? I mean, there's how you fashion your life and who helps you along and what your schools are and what your neighborhood is.
Exactly.
And what the pattern of the family has been and whether or not your parents have been in prison. It's such a big issue. And it seems to me as though we just don't seem to care very much about it.
Well, there has to be a moral imperative
to
attack this issue, not only from a social but a political standpoint of view.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to in no way, shape, or form say that prisons are not needed in certain instances. So, 'cause I've met people in my career who should have been in double jails. But those were far and few between. I discourage parents from saying that kids need to go to prison to get a lesson. Sometimes that lesson backfires because there are more hardened criminals in prison, and sometimes it turns a first-time offender or a minor offender into a major offender because he's in there among habitual criminals, those people who are basically hell-bent on what their careers are. There are some people who don't want to change. So if you put a person in there, you have ability to change with those individuals. He sometimes has to become one of those individuals to survive. So you wind up creating a better criminal sometimes by putting a person who could be rehabilitated in jail with individuals that are actually jails are actually meant for.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, also, that survival instinct still stays with the person when they're released instead of necessarily reaching for something or trying to achieve something. They only know survival. So,
very strong. It's a very strong instinct.
Yep.
Thank you, Ed, for the call. Chester in Athens. Hi, Chester.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We are not a nation like Honduras where people are incarcerated and no money is spent on them. We're spending $90,000 to $100,000 a year per inmate. I would like to know why can't we, with that money, do rehabilitation, do occupational enhancement while we are incarcerated. We're not a cut-rate nation as far as what we spend. We're not getting, it's like in Medicare, I think there's more egregious fraud in the program. I'm wondering if one of your guests could comment, is there a lot of misused funds if we're spending that kind of money?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a lot of money. Why don't we do more with it?
That's our question. That's the right on point. That's the same thing that we're asking.
That is right on point what he's saying. We give the public this perception that we are mollycoddling people when we put them in jail. They always say that it's like being at a country club. And like Mandela just said, try locking yourself in a room and depriving yourself of sensory items that you need and see how that feels and can multiply that into years. So no matter what you think, a person being locked up is not a country club. Your rights being taken away from you are not, it does not feel good. So while you have that person in that situation, why not give him his dignity back and give him a sense of belonging to the community and make him a part of the community? I'm not adverse to giving them an education while they're there, because to me, if he went in with a third grade education and comes out with a third grade education, he's going to do the same thing he did to get money and finances and to support himself that he did when he went in there. I'm spending the money anyway. But when the public hears about prisoners getting college degrees or prisoners getting certificates, they say, well, my son could get that. He hasn't committed a crime.
Right.
But that's not the moral issue. The moral issue, if I send this person back to the neighborhood with no hope, with no prospects of getting a job, no prospects of healing himself, then what is he going to do? The same thing he did. So we wind up spending that same amount of money we incarcerated him with before on him again. And when you look at it, you've spent $1 million on an individual throughout his career that could have been basically spent on him working or being a productive part of society.
That Honduras story was just horrendous,
yes.
Wasn't it? You must, having worked in prisons long time. Oh, my gosh. No way to get out. Oh, terrible story. Chester, thanks for the call. We need to pause for a moment, and we will return this hour of the program. We're talking about a campaign hoping to reduce Wisconsin's prison population to 11,000 from where it is now, anywhere from 22,000 to 24,000 by the year 2015. Reverend Willie Briscoe, president of the Milwaukee Inner City Allied for Hope, and he also, pertinent to our conversation, really knows prisons because he was superintendent of the Milwaukee County House of Correction for a number of years. He is also Associate Minister of the New Covenant Baptist Church. Also joining us, Mandela Barnes, lead organizer for Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope. This is the Milwaukee group that is part of a statewide group asking the state to look at this issue and take action. Our phones have been very busy, but keep this number in mind, 800-486-8655. You can also send an email if you would like to go that route. That's talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Melanie in Grafton, our next caller. Hi, Melanie. Melanie, are you there? Okay, Melanie's not there. Carlson in Madison. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Oh, sorry?
Go right ahead.
Yeah. This is a really wonderful program you have on. I'm a graduate student in the Neuroscience and Public Policy Program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. My research interests center largely around the intersection between mental health and criminal justice. And it's really encouraging to hear about this initiative because it's a great example of where scientific interests, religious interests, social activism interests can converge on the same problem. Especially because, I mean, with the way that current policies are, especially with truth and sentencing policy, it's really difficult to find policy outlets that can improve this problem. And the possibility of diversion programs like the mental health court in Eau Claire County, the juvenile center in Madison, the Mendota program, can reduce recidivism rates a great deal, especially because recidivism rates are so high in mentally ill individuals. So I just really wanted to commend you guys for, getting the ball rolling, so to speak, on an issue that hasn't received as much publicity as it definitely should have.
Mandela, you want to respond?
Yeah, definitely. I actually just got a message that said we're up to about 300 religious leaders who've signed on to this campaign. And I would really like to, you know, extend this opportunity for other religious leaders who may be tuning into the show right now to, you know, get involved in this issue. We do have our website is prayforjusticenwi.org.
And not just religious leaders either. Yes.
Right.
You too.
Right.
We would welcome you aboard.
Well, yeah.
It sounds like you may want to be a part of this, Carlson.
Yeah, well, you know, it's something that I am considering as a major component of my dissertation work, so.
Right, what part of the state are you in again? You're in Madison?
I'm in Madison, yeah.
Okay, because the Madison group, I believe they had their kickoff already, but definitely there is a Madison group who is, you know, a part of our statewide organization who is on this and would, you know, love to have you be a part of the of this campaign.
Yeah, the hope is that one of the ways that science can contribute to the dialogue is by bringing our understanding of the neural circuits that underlie disruptions and sort of like generating antisocial behavior and mm-hmm. ways that they can be rehabilitated, whether it's, basically with psychological treatment the way that you're discussing. And that's why we think diversion programs are effective, because we can see what's different in the way that the minds of people who have issues with mental illness or who are predisposed to sort of careers in criminality can function a little bit differently, and, you know, we can work with those differences and understand what treatments will be most effective.
Right, yeah, treatment programs are definitely more effective than incarceration alone. It's just going to take more than $1 million across the state to make it truly, before we can truly see a change and a difference.
Thank you, Carlson, for the call. Can you give us that website again? I didn't.
It's prayforjusticenwi.org.
That's all together.
Yep.
Pray for justice. Pray for justice in WI.org. .org. Thank you. Let's go to Susan in Oregon. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I had been a high school teacher and began teaching for the criminal justice system, and I taught in a vocational program for 10 years, and this was at a minimum security level. And one of the things that I noticed first when I began teaching there is that I had a background of building bridges with my students in the high school setting and creating relationships of trust, which facilitated the teaching system in high school. But in the prison system, of course, that's not allowed, and you're supposed to stay very impersonal with students. And I just felt that the whole experience of teaching in the prisons showed me that there's a real criminal thinking going on, not only among the inmates, but among the people that run the prisons. And the prisons tended to treat, I always felt like the prisons treated the staff as inmates, and there was a lot of distrust of inmates and distrust of staff, and little programming went on until right before the inmates were getting ready to leave. So a lot of their time in prison was spent sitting until they were getting ready to leave the system, and then they got their programming. And it always struck me odd that there was never any follow-up after my program to see, was there any success in what they had been taught? Did they go into careers that were related to my vocational training that I gave them? Or did they go into some type of work? We were not allowed to have any contact with any inmates after they left. And I always felt that there should have been follow-up. And I felt there was not that much support for the inmates after they left. And then that's where we would see a lot of recidivism.
Reverend Briscoe.
Exactly. I was sitting here nodding as you were speaking. Isn't it ironic that the very people who have the closest contact with the inmates who could possibly influence their lives are taught to keep distance and not to get personal with them? So they are in a situation where they can be helped, but you're told the staff to stay separate, stay distant, do not have any contact, no influence on their personal lives, but yet and still you expect for them to be rehabilitated. The very people that are taught to supervise them are also taught to be antagonists. So you have this force that is antagonizing each other throughout the whole period of incarceration. That is something that we have never gotten right in this country. And until we realize it, that those people who have the most immediate contact, who have the most influence on the lives of those individuals, can be the most critical change for those individuals, then we might get somewhere. But that was what you just said is something that frustrated me throughout my entire career, that they told you, if you ever tried to do something for the inmates, you would get credited being an inmate lover. And that was the worst thing you could get in your correctional career.
An inmate lover.
Yes.
Here's an email from Tom in Washburn. Wisconsin created the Community Support Program for close support of people with major mental illnesses. So there is a tradition of working with rather than against people who require some help.
Well, and we're not saying that there's no advocacy out there, but it has to increase. It has to be large enough to encompass the whole state and so that no one can fall through the cracks. There are some people out doing some tremendous work, but it's just so few of them. I don't want to put a good friend of mine on the spot, but Judge Jeffrey Crimmins, who's the chief judge, is a great advocate for this program and this programming. And it doesn't distract from his position as a judge. We have got to get people in criminal justice, people in law enforcement, to realize that looking at something critically and out of a different way does not distract from your duties. Matter of fact, it enhances your duties to look on at every phase of this, because there's a lot of people that can be saved. I saw some of the greatest artists, some of the greatest electricians, some of the greatest speech writers, some of the greatest just all around individuals who just needed a diversion in their life to put them on the tracks to a great career. I saw this. I saw lawyers in jail who sit up and drew up their own papers, but these individuals just missed that one little thing, that little follow-up, that someone that encouraging, that mentored them to set them on the path of a great career.
That's a pretty powerful statement. Yeah. Let's go. Susan, thanks for the call. Melanie in Grafton, hi.
Hello. Thank you so much for this program. And tears came to my eyes when you did the introduction. And I can't thank, you know, all three of you enough for, you know, shedding some light into this really deep problem. And, you know, I just want to make a couple comments. I've kind of a timely matter for me. I have a brother, he's 28, that's been in and out of the prison and jail system since he was 15 years old, all relating to drug problems. And I wish that there was more programs, and I'm so happy that you've created this organization, and I'm glad that there's a place that I can go to and hopefully participate in helping make some of these changes in our community. And I'm breaking up a little bit just because I'm so thankful. Thank you.
Thank you, Melanie.
God bless you.
Thanks. Julio in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank you for having this topic on. I just have a quick comment, and hopefully your guest can add a little more to it. I know that personally I feel that the criminal justice system is just a really good example of institutionalized racism. And I know with the conversation we've been having that race has come up, but it's really been skirted, and I'm wondering if maybe your guest can add just a little more to probably the disproportionate amount of minorities that are sentenced to long prison terms and whatnot. So, yes. And I'll take this.
Thanks, Julio. I'm sure they can address it.
Right, yeah. Our African-American population in the state of Wisconsin is around 6%. However, the prison population is 51% African-American. With Truth in Sentencing, I mean, African Americans have been disproportionately affected across the entire nation with drug charges and the failed war on drugs.
And if you look at cities around the country, you'll find out where there are what you might call ghettos or sections of the city where people are put in or called poor sections or disproportionately economically deprived sections. That's what Wisconsin has in Milwaukee. And that's what Minnesota doesn't have. They are kind of diversely split up. But if you really want to get a handle on this, there's a great book called The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, one of the greatest books that I've read. And she really breaks down the racial disparity, the economic disparity, and a lot of the social disparity that leads to the disproportionate incarceration of people of color in this country. And it basically took place when the war on drugs started in 1982 is when it actually accelerated, where they just became targeting these communities.
Yeah. Is she booked, Rhonda? Rhonda's doing five things at once, but she will be with us soon. I saw her on television. She was with us before the book came out talking about similar issues, but right. She's got a lot to say. She's got a lot to say. She'll be with us, so we'll let you know when that will happen. Larry in Kingston. Hi, Larry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was incarcerated in Chesapeake Bay, Virginia, and went to college while I was in prison. And, I had a lot of time on my hands, and I learned more during that time than I ever did in high school or even after. Inmates got to take basic college classes, and I excelled and I helped other inmates, and there was a lot of bonding and between races, and a lot of goodwill happens when there's an educational program in a prison.
What happened when you got out, Larry?
Well, I was a medic in the Air Force before that. I worked home health care and stuff, and I eventually I now run my own business. I have a pest control business.
Mm. Reverend Briscoe.
That's just an example of what can happen when you do programming. But one thing that we want to do, Larry, is intercept before those people get to that level. Now, we also want to have great programs in prison, but we want to have programs that divert people from prison. Yours is a success story that I'm sure that you're proud of and the people around you are proud of, and I'm glad to hear it. And there need to be more of those success stories that comes out of our prisons, but we want to make sure that those people don't get into those prisons, because for every success story that goes through those doors, there are many stories of disasters and careers and opportunities wasted when they go behind those walls.
Yeah. Thanks, Larry, very much for the call. We go to Joe in Madison. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. I've been a jail chaplain for a couple of years, and through a couple of other experiences have seen that getting into prison isn't really all that simple. Typically the process is somebody's in trouble a lot frequently. There's a lot of chances, second chances, third, fourth, et cetera, et cetera. And one in prisons have tried hard to get there. What are you guys going to do specifically that is going to change where people are going to decide they're not going to work so hard to get in prison?
Mendel?
Well, with 22,000 people in prison, I wouldn't say it's too hard to get into. That's a pretty huge party going on. A lot of people got VIP passes to get in as well, apparently. what we're saying we need to do is incarcerate much less at a lower rate than we do now. If you think 22,000 inmates is a decent number for people to be in prison, then we have to work even harder to change the public opinion. Because if the state of Minnesota, with a very similar crime rate, can incarcerate fewer than half of the people that we do, then we're doing something completely wrong. We're putting people in jail for the wrong reasons. I wouldn't say that it's too hard to get in prison.
More phone calls in a moment. This hour of the program, we're talking about a campaign. It will soon be a statewide campaign that hopes to reduce the prison population in the state of Wisconsin from 22 to 24,000 now to 11,000 by 2015. We have two people who are with the MICA organization, Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope, and they are involved in this campaign. Actually, they're very busy people. They're having a voter ID press conference coming up later today. We'll ask about that as we continue. Our guests are Reverend Willie Briscoe, and he had a 25-year distinguished career in law enforcement and corrections before retiring as deputy superintendent of the Milwaukee County House of Corrections. He is president of MICA, and he is an associate minister of the New Covenant Baptist Church located here in Milwaukee. Also joining us in our studios in Milwaukee, Mandela Barnes, who is lead organizer for Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope. He's a native of Milwaukee, and he has been working since returning from Alabama A&M University, where he went to school. He's been working with MICA as a tireless advocate for social justice. And we'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our phone lines have been very busy, which is a good sign. We haven't talked about this issue as much as we should have, and we're happy to do so today. It's just that the lines are crowded. So keep trying. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Deborah in Madison. Hi, Deborah.
Hello. Thank you for the show and for your work. My comment is addiction and alcoholism are known to be medical disorders, and technology is now showing that there's impairment in the brain in the areas of judgment and decision-making for somebody who has an addiction, and yet someone with 8 drunk driving tickets gets sent to prison with minimal treatment opportunities. So, and then they get out, and eventually they can get a license back without showing any sign of having had treatment for this medical disorder. It's treated as a character flaw. What ideas do you have for improving addiction treatment?
Mandela.
You got to have an exit strategy. I mean, that would be, I see a treatment package that would, you know, one that could divert someone. And then we have someone habitual offender, like a repeat drunken driver. You know, if they're going to be in prison, when they come out, again, that you can't just transition into society. Even when you graduate college, there's still career services that work with you to make sure that your college experience is worthwhile and that you're able to get a job. That needs to be the same thing that happens in the prison system. When people are released, there needs to be ongoing consultation to ensure that they're not going to come back. But our prison system, our correction system, isn't built for people to stay out. It's predicated upon people coming in. So if you can release someone, and I hate to say it, but it's not an issue. It seems to not be an issue for the state for whether people go back in or come back out. The people live and profit from prison labor, from prison enrollment, I'll even say, because. And so whatever can be done to make sure that there are people constantly going into the system, that's what's going to happen. And that's why I don't believe that there are programs like that to treat people like, for example, with that have addictions like alcoholism.
Here's an email that's coming in from Marianne from Caledonia. I'm sure both of you are familiar with this. Frontline did a two-hour program of former prisoners trying to intervene with young street kids in Chicago. Violence Interrupters is the name of the program. It was striking to see this group of men gathered around the table saying they had 500 years of prison experience behind them and how they wanted to use that to prevent the young from following in their footsteps. Is there such a program here in Milwaukee or in other cities that you know of?
Well, actually, in this program, we're going to use ex-offenders to give their testimonies as to what treatment did for them instead of the incarceration rate. So those are valuable stories and valuable assets that we can use on both sides of this, somehow to show that it doesn't work and locking people up, and on the other hand, to show when people who were locked up who got the intervention that they needed, who can come back and tell that there's a difference between intervention and between just locking someone up. Mm. I liked what she said earlier about the addiction being a medical issue. The medical issue is what led to the criminal issue. So why do we treat it criminally on the other end instead of taking care of the medical problem first? So both of those callers in that email are related in the fact that we really have to focus on what it is that led these people to where they are. Those individuals that had went in and came out are valuable assets to this program and to any program to tell their stories, to give testimonies. And it's going to add to our own, what you might say, agenda to show that treatment is necessary.
And how will you conduct this campaign? Will it be from the pulpit? Will it be on television? What will you do?
I mean, this campaign has gone beyond the pulpit now. I mean, our statewide organization started as an interfaith organization. However, we're bringing on partners from all across the state. I mean, we have to first change the public opinion before we can do anything. And that, you know, starts, again, we see it's a moral issue because, you know, religious traditions teach us that justice is related to restoration and not just retribution. So if we can start the conversation here in the churches, in the synagogues, in the mosques, if we can start the conversation there, bring other people in and somehow work to change the public opinion on the issue, and we bring other people on board, it's going to influence legislation. And, you know, I hate that our government in the state of Wisconsin is so polarized right now, because I would hate to see this become a partisan issue, because that is exactly what it's not. It's not a partisan issue at all, because, you know, honestly, we've been failed by both parties on the issue of criminal justice reform. And then, you know, when we can really, again, I just have to go back to the state of Alabama, because the state of Alabama still celebrates Confederate Day as a state holiday. If we're behind a state that celebrates Confederate Day as a state holiday, then where does that put Wisconsin?
Joe in Milwaukee, you're on the air. Hi, Joe.
I'm glad someone finally brought up the issue of race, because I think it's a major factor in why we have such an enormous system in this country, which has become a major source of, obviously, of employment. You're 5 to 6 times as likely to go to prison in this country if you're a person of color than if you're not. The other issue, which I think is essential, 40 years ago, we were 5% of the world's population. We had 5% of its prisoners. Today, we're still 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the world's prisoners. I think it was mentioned that we have such an enormous, but 25% of the world's prisons. The other issue was religion has been brought up again and again in this discussion, but I think it's important to remember that penitentiary is a word that is religious. It comes from a congregation in the Vatican, and it means doing penance. And sadly, I think too many people in this country still see prisons as places to suffer and do penance. What we need is a system, for example, in the Netherlands. You cannot get a job in a penitentiary or a prison in the Netherlands unless you are a skilled rehabilitator. That's your job, to rehabilitate, not to punish, not to put people there, you know, to do penance. And until we get around to training people to do the job of being, you know, employees in our prisons where they're there to rehabilitate and not to punish, it's never going to change.
Reverend Briscoe.
I really appreciate that comment, because we spend, you should look at the budget, what it spends for tactical equipment from prisons. It's tactical equipment that's designed to prevent riots, or to put down riots, or to prevent escapes, or to subdue prisoners. All of that is militarism that really is basically not even needed in a prison. Because if you supervise a prison with 500 guards and about 20,000 inmates, there's no way you can prevent them from taking over that prison. So why not devote that skill and that energy into training those individuals, 500 individuals, to be rehabilitators? to be facilitators, to be actually those people's gateway to the outside, back into society, instead of having a military force that's against an unarmed force, and the whole time that they are both there, they're antagonizing one another, or the antagonists. So that is what he said was pertinent about the Netherlands. We have an entire reverse system of incarceration in this country. We make the average citizen think that we're punishing inmates, individuals, what they did. They're going to do hard time. We're not going to feed them, or we're not going to give them sparing visits and sparing outside sensory connections, and we're going to make them suffer. So that's how you train a pit bull to fight.
And on that note, I'm sorry we didn't get to voter ID, but please return. We'll talk about that one later. I know it's a subject of a press conference. The website, once again, is
PrayForJusticeNWI.org. And again, we hope that if you're in the Milwaukee area that you can join us for our kickoff on Monday, February 20th, which is this Monday coming up at 9 a.m. at St. Benedict the Moor Catholic Church, and that's 1015 West State Street.
Thank you. Thank you both very much.
Thank you
for being with us. Mandela Barnes, lead organizer for MICA, and Reverend Willie Briscoe, president of MICA and pastor at New Covenant Baptist Church. Thanks to both of them. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. And thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for all of your calls, too. We'll be with you again Monday.